Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Private Eye office joined by Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Ian Hislop. Normally this is, it's a lighthearted show and we're here to talk about the news and make it a bit funny. Today's going to be a slightly different kind of show, I'm afraid, because there are 10 years to save the West. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is the finding of a new book by a very respected parliamentarian and MP for, is it North, West Norfolk?
Some part of Norfolk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Liz Truss.
Yes.
And the book's been serialised in the Mail and the Mail on Sunday, and it's pretty shocking hearing, I mean, what's that, 2034? It's not long. We'll all be here to see it.
Well, hopefully, but yes. The thing that's really weird about it is I wouldn't have put any unit of time in the headline if I were her, given that the main thing she's known for is, whatever it is, 49 days to be Prime Minister. That was presumably the rejected title.
Yeah.
We're at a disadvantage here because it's not out yet. It's heavily embargoed. That's the kryptonite, Andy, that we're talking about.
We have seen the best bits, and that's an indicator of what the rest of it's like.
We've had 3 days of a serialisation so far in the Mail and the Mail on Sunday. There's not a lot about saving the West in there. It does seem to be largely concentrating on those 49 days, doesn't it?
Yeah. I presume that, bless the people who do the serialisations at the Mail, they were like, no one cares, Liz, about
well,
that.
I mean, as a service, to listeners, for those of you who don't have a password to behind the new Mail Plus paywall, it can basically summarise in the last line of today's serialisation, speaking on Monday, which just says, things had not worked out as I had hoped.
Now, that is a good title. Probably for a song.
My recollection of what we are, we know that possibly Dylan or someone left fleas in the Downing Street flat.
Yes.
There was no gold wallpaper installed. The gold wallpaper was only theoretical. Right. We also know that. She couldn't get her Ricardo delivered to number 10 Downing Street, and that was an outrage.
Stuck in the gates.
And also amusing when her slogan had been deliver.
Deliver and deliver.
No, but also the fact that all the furniture had gone with Boris, and so they ordered some new stuff from John Lewis, but it wasn't delivered in time for Truss to stop being Prime Minister. So presumably there was a delivery. Sunak just had to take delivery of someone else's massive consignment of furniture.
I do like the idea that basically it's such a middle-class problem that you're not getting your deliveries and that's why you think, no, the West is doomed now.
But I do think it is a serious matter. If John Lewis can't come up with stuff in 7 weeks, that is quite a long time, you know, unless it's really bespoke upholstery that they're needing. You know.
Did they not just get back in all of the John Lewis stuff that Carrie Simmons rejected when the non-gold wallpaper went up? Yeah. I mean, that's presumably still in storage somewhere, isn't
it? The poor local chapter of John Lewis who have to deal with this array of returns, refunds, non-deliveries.
This is the problem with the Conservatives in the last decade or so. There's no consistency. Not of taste or policy. So do we like John Lewis? Do we hate John Lewis? And make your mind up.
The other bit I liked was the sense that Boris and Carrie had taken all of the stuff with them. And I thought, I bet they, when they go to hotels, I bet they take every last bit of shampoo.
And the light bulbs. Yeah.
Unlike the Camerons, who left the climbing frame, their kids' climbing frame, in the garden at Downing Street, and it was used then by Boris and Carrie's children.
I think it was used by Dominic Cummings.
A climbing frame sitting there the entire time that Theresa May lived in Downing Street. I just wonder if she occasionally, in her lighter moments, went out and just sort of clambered up to the top of it and look over the wall. Sorry, it's just an image I like.
Just have a smoking a fag on the top of it, thinking, where did it all go wrong?
So, this all strikes me as tittle tattle.
Yeah, it is.
Where's the stuff that she can do again at American conferences about saving the West? We've just not seen it.
No. The interesting thing is, lots of it, I mean, particularly today, which deals with the final fortnight of the premiership, because you have to divide it up, obviously. This is from the 6th to the 20th of October.
Right.
And the first day was about the death of the Queen and getting in and all of this. The list of people blamed is extraordinary. So I totted up Bank of England, OBR, Joe Biden, Kwasi Kwarteng, backbench Tory MPs, the culture of leaking, more bank officials, Kwasi again, Treasury establishment, Jeremy Hunt, who she made Chancellor and then moaned that he's a Treasury man to his core, Suella Braverman, and then she eventually says she nearly blames her husband at one point, which is very, very unfair.
Does the list include Liz Truss at any point?
It doesn't. But she manages towards the very end to say, well, I have managed to avoid an economic meltdown here, without at any point suggesting who, you know, might have kicked that off. So
it's essentially the political philosophy of Shaggy, isn't it? It wasn't me all the way through.
Since the extracts came out, she's been interviewed by The Spectator and about the pensions and the risk of a pensions exposure, which she says is the thing that really tanked the mini budget. She said, in retrospect, if I had seen the iceberg, I wouldn't have steered towards it. And it's like, okay, so you are creeping towards a sort of revelation that you might have been in charge.
I should point out that Private Eye revealed that she had been the captain of the Titanic at least six times. We did endless permutations of whether it was the iceberg's fault. Eventually, but that is brilliant news that she is beginning to move towards some sort of self-knowledge.
But I think you're right, Andy. I think she spent a bit too much time with Steve Bannon and the kind of American kooks, because a lot of it is very deep state. So she complains about the fact the Office of Budget Responsibility, which was given that role of independently marking the homework by another Tory, by George Osborne, they're one of the people to blame because they weren't on side. And, you know, the Bank of England also not sufficiently on side. Then she moans a bit about the fact there weren't enough commentators who'd go on the airwaves and support her. Really interesting. That's something you also heard a lot about from the Corbyn camp, right? That there were not enough people who would go on TV and make that case.
Do you get to choose exactly which institutions exist if you become Prime Minister? Not really. You know, you can't pick and choose. You can't say, well, the OBR just won't apply to me.
Right. It's a sort of Tinkerbell theory of politics where you just think if people just believed in what I'm doing hard enough, then it would all be fine. Yeah. And I think, you know, she was trying to do something that was unorthodox, fine. And you might say the same thing about Brexit. But it was also the fact that she just front-loaded a huge amount of tax cuts that even her own party didn't want. You know, the cut to the 45p rate of tax. That was a Tory revolution. Labour, if you remember, during that entire time, were just basically kind of like, well, we'll just stand back, let this one happen. Find out amongst yourselves, lads. They didn't really have to do a lot of opposition to Liz Truss because it was the Tory party was doing a very good job of that already.
My worry is that former prime ministers never disappear now. I mean, you don't have to put them in the cabinet as foreign secretary, obviously. That's just asking for them to still be around. But there is a sense in which you can now go fail and hang around and you're still an unexploded bomb. And she gets an enormous amount of coverage. I mean, we're talking about her, which is probably reprehensible. But that is because people are still saying, well, I mean, she's not all bad, is she?
I have terrible news for you, which is that although her former speechwriter, Asa Bennett, said, you know, she's not going to make a comeback at the weekend. In her interview, apparently, with Ian Dale, which will be online by the time that people hear this, she repeatedly refuses to deny that she's going to make a comeback. So you're right, there is a problem that both she and Boris Johnson are both hanging around the margins of American conferences going, maybe I could do it again, maybe I can have another go, this second time's the charm.
And Boris actually has to criticise Cameron as well. He's now an ex-prime minister criticising an ex-prime minister because he's nearly come back already.
I think what you're really saying is what we could do with is a prolonged period of sulk like we got from Edward Heath, isn't it? Yeah. Just kind of sit on the back bench glowering at Mrs Thatcher for 20 years.
Can you not just do that?
Yeah. Is it because the financial opportunities for ex-prime ministers are so much bigger than they used to be? Because if I think of people like Ted Heath, or John Major to an extent, you think, well, you'll probably go off and do a bit of maybe financial stuff, maybe a bit of charity stuff, and then Tony Blair broke the mold and started the Institute.
I'm not sure. Do you remember Mrs. Thatcher went off and was a lobbyist for British American Tobacco? I mean, she made an absolute fortune.
Okay.
And she would pop up and everyone would say, oh, she's a backseat driver, she's interfering with Major. But she did kind of bide her moments and then come in and make them pretty devastating when she did. But she was not doing a column for the Daily Mail every Saturday.
But you do kind of see the character of ex-prime ministers in this, in that Theresa May has basically been a kind of, you know, just a backbench MP, a workaday. She's turned up, she's now stepping down at the next election, obviously. Gordon Brown popped up again this week. He's basically devoted his post-premiership life to campaigning about child poverty, right, and not taking huge amounts of money from people. So it is possible, should you be able to get over your ego and desire for attention and money in order to have a really useful post-premiership life. I can't explain to you why it is that is not the course that Liz Truss and Boris Johnson have chosen. It's a mystery.
Can I just read you my favourite bit from the Liz Truss book? Mm. It's pretty much the one thing that she seems really pleased about in her time in Downing Street, which is when she was appearing at the Tory Party conference, and she said she was in the conference centre, and the conference was one of the few occasions when my daughters Frances and Liberty were able to join us. They were smuggled in under the guise of being Welsh young conservatives. Little did the lobby journalists getting into the lifts with Rosie and Molly from Cardiff North know that they were my daughters incognito. What story does she think she was hiding from the journalists at that point? Prime Minister's daughters in same venue as her. It's the glee with which she thinks she's got one over on people. You're allowed to have your kids at the conference centre list. That's fine. That wasn't the bit anyone had a problem with.
Is it just that the desire to be deceitful is just unstoppable? And you have to just make something up? Fancy that being the best time you had. Was when you told journalists something that wasn't true.
There's also something very funny about the fact that both she and George Osborne have a daughter called Liberty. There was obviously a vogue in the sort of 2000s, if you're in that. But I imagine there's probably even now some little baby Brexits, you know, or something. Or, you know.
Have you met my daughter Market Forces?
Yeah, blob.
So now let's come to a story which, again, has historical resonance, but is also very of the now. And that's the kind of stuff we like to provide on this podcast, is context, but also, news. So this is about honey trapping in Westminster, and it's about sexual politics, because obviously the story about Westminster honey trapping has been enormous. Various MPs getting fruity messages from fruity young people and quickly sending back photos of their genitals. And that it's happened in the same week that we found out that Harold Wilson, friend of the podcast, had an affair, but not with the person everyone thought he was having an affair with, which is terribly exciting stuff. And Adam, you're the long-standing historian of all sorts.
It wasn't just the pound in his pocket. He really was pleased to see her.
Oh, God.
This is the news that that someone in Downing Street was feeling the full white heat of the technological revolution from Harold Wilson.
Horrible. But it was absolutely
wasn't,
horrible.
As rumours were.
Faxing her pictures
at
of his penis.
The time. I don't know. Maybe there may have been Polaroids involved. They would have been
the era?
Older technology at that point. But no, the woman in question was not Marcia Williams, Lady Falconder, who everyone or a lot of people assumed at the time he was having an affair with, but in fact, Janet Hewlett Davis, who is a fairly kind of unknown figure. I had a quick look back through the IBAC catalogue to see if she'd even been mentioned in the 60s or 70s. No, never cropped up at all. She was deputy press secretary to Joe Haynes, who did feature a lot in Private Eye over the years. And it was he who popped up. He is now about a million years old. And he popped up at the week last week to reveal in the last days in Downing Street, Harold Wilson had indeed been taking great happiness from an affair which he had with Janet Hewlett Davies.
Why have we found this out now?
Well, this is an odd thing with Joe Haynes. Joe Haynes and his pal Bernard Donoghue also worked in Downing Street under Harold Wilson. They sort of remember stuff. About every sort of 15 or 20 years, they suddenly remember something else. And curiously, it's never anything about the time they both spent working for Robert Maxwell, about which their memories are extremely hazy.
But
it's
generally mine's very sharp on that period.
It's generally some revelation from Danish. I have to say, this is far from their best revelation. I mean, 20 years ago, the pair of them popped up and said that they'd actually just remembered Harold Wilson's personal physician, Dr. Joe Stone, offering to murder his right-hand woman, Marcia Falconder, because she was causing such a nightmare for him in Downing Street, and cover it up. Which, you know, by the standards of political scandals, is kind of right up there. I mean,
that's real echoes of thought, though. I'm always worried when you hear another scandal. This is very like the last one. And hearing this one, if you remember, everyone assumed John Major was having an affair with someone else, which turned out not to be true. And actually he was having an affair with Edwina Curry.
Yeah.
So we keep getting these patterns.
And they always arrive a long time afterwards, yes. Don't they? Yes, yeah, years afterwards, not at the time when they would have been particularly useful. I mean, with John Major, you have to say that one probably would have been the end of his premiership, because at the time he was, of course, pushing his back to basics and Victorian values, and all sorts of his ministers and his MPs were having to resign all over the place for being caught in bed with people. And Harold Wilson, we're talking 74, 76, it was still a kind of different attitude to sexual politics, if you like, in those days. I think it would certainly have been problematic. He took legal action over a suggestion that he was having an affair with Falconder, who was his kind of, just to explain for younger readers, kind of not just his right-hand woman, she was an extraordinary figure. She was kind of Dominic Cummings and Alistair Campbell combined. She was an incredibly powerful figure in Downing Street.
But also something, the way that I've always read about it is that there's a sort of slightly odd sadomasochistic overtone to the way that she used to sort of weirdly control him, right?
And this is much, much more interesting than the sexual stuff, is the actual power dynamics of that relationship.
Yeah.
That she would call him the C-word in front of other members of staff, and she would, at one point she actually, and again, all of this is coming from previous revelations from Bernard Donoghue and Joe Haynes, keeping us entertained for decades now. But at one point she stole a load of government papers and locked them in her garage and refused to give them back to Wilson. And he had to enroll her brother to break into her garage over the weekend and retrieve these kind of red boxes for him. And they were just the most bizarre things going on.
It's quite hard because I wrote a screenplay about Barbara Carson. I interviewed Joe Haynes for it. And I remember he had this, as you say, terrifically like bitchy sense of like these grievances that he was still nursing 50 years on. But there's quite a... Barbara Carson used to flirt with Harold Wilson quite a lot and complained to him about how the cabinet table was sort of snagging her tights and sending him, like, passing him little notes about her hosiery and cabinet. And it's quite hard to acknowledge the fact that one of the reasons that Harold Wilson was kind of okay with strong women around him was that he quite liked strong women in a slightly now eyebrow-raising kind of way, right?
So, yeah, possibly, yeah.
Lady Falkinder is now dead, so we can finally stop hedging these bets about, ooh, did she have an affair? I mean, she did. She really did, didn't she?
Oh, well, I mean, she made the revelation to Mary Wilson, who's kind of the forgotten figure in all this, Mrs. Wilson, famous diarist for Private Eye for many, many years. She said to her at one point, I have something to say to you. I had sexual relations with your husband 6 times in 1956, and it wasn't satisfactory. Which is just such an extraordinary statement. What was Mrs. Wilson supposed to say to this? Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Maybe he wasn't at his best. Do you want another go? I don't know.
I'm sort of trip advisor.
But Francis Wheen, a former deputy editor of this august publication, wrote a screenplay for the BBC, which was then sued. For making the suggestion that there had been a relationship between the two of them. And it apparently will never be shown again. And she was sort of active legally right up to the end, Lady Falkinder, to stop anyone saying that she'd had an affair with him.
She employed our favourite firm of solicitors, Carter Fuck, to jump down the throats of anyone who suggested either about the affair or that she had some hand in the Lavender List, which was up until the point that Boris Johnson did his resignation honours, the most scandalously cronyous and disgusting honours list ever issued by a Prime Minister.
I was going to say, can you, for our one listener under the age of 40, please remind everyone what the Lavender List was? And why is it called that? Was it written on lavender notepaper?
Well, this is Joe Haynes, again. Yeah. It's always him. He's our main source on all of this. Claimed that it was written on lavender notepaper, but when it actually emerged, it turned out to be a shade that Mrs. Haynes, Joe Haynes' wife, said, no, that's lilac, dear. So we've been calling it the wrong thing for all these years, apparently. But yes, this was the list of cronies which was drawn up when Harold Wilson suddenly resigned in mysterious circumstances, in which may or may not be related to any of this, in 1976. And it was written in Lady Falkinder's handwriting, although she always maintained at the instructions of Harold Wilson, but had an awful lot of friends of hers rather than his on there, including, and then we, you know, this is where we get into the really weirdness of it, James Goldsmith, who at that point was trying to sue Private Eye out of existence and had been paying people to steal our rubbish, some of which subsequently turned up at number 10, and Harold Wilson himself started talking around political journalists saying, do you want the Private Eye address book? And trying to sell the names of our contacts. I know, this is how you react to 70s politics, Andy. That's the noise people make. What? Also may or may not have been bankrolling Jeremy Thorpe in his attempts to murder his former gay lover, Norman Scott.
Wait, who may have been bankrolling him?
Goldsmith, maybe.
Oh, Goldsmith.
Yeah, I heard that as Harold Wilson was bankrolling Jeremy Thorpe. And I was like, what was happening in the 70s?
That's right. I'm going to say, as someone who has actually written a novel based on quite a lot of this stuff, Beneath the Streets, first of the Tommy Wildwood thrillers, All Good Bookshops, folks, number 3 coming next year.
Cut that bit.
You can. Don't cut that bit. It's the only reason I'm here. All of this stuff, you are safe to say now. Everyone involved is dead, apart from Bernard Donoghue and Joe Haynes, who are probably a bit like Rupert Murdoch with wives, have several revelations ahead of them a few years down the line.
And the thing to remember about them is that whatever you want to say about them, just repeating that they both worked for Robert Maxwell, I think is sufficiently defamatory to end any further reliance on their testimony. The reason that when Adam recounts these just unbelievable stories of corruption and sexual malpractice and lunacy from the 70s, it is partly so that when younger listeners say, well, politics has never been as bad as it is now. And the honours system, honestly, I mean, the honours system under Wilson was about as bad as it gets. Right. And Lady Falkinder, Lady Slagheap, as she was known, after a corrupt deal with a group with a bunch of slag heaps, which she'd bought with some friends of hers. And I mean, corruption is not new.
Yeah. As far as we know, Ed Davey has not had a great Dane shot at any point, just to make that clear for the record.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And if you want to know what a slag heap is, we'll put it in the notes of the show, but it's
It's a thing from the 70s.
It is sort of a thing from the 70s, yeah.
But I mean, there, we have some pretty amazing scandals going on of our own, don't we, Andy? In,
so we're now coming to William Bragg and the honey trap?
Spear fishing.
Yeah. So spear phishing with a PH is a version of phishing, which is where you just try and get information out of people. But it's called spear phishing because it's targeted. Mm. So you go to people and you...
Is that why? I thought it was just that they were blackmailing pictures of their spears out of them, so to speak. Right, okay.
I'm glad to deter you from that interpretation. No, it's because you are, particularly over WhatsApp, if you send somebody a message that implies that you've already met them, lots of MPs and people working in politics receive messages like that all the time. And so the theory is that you just win people's trust by saying, because this is what happened in the William Bragg case, the classic approach from Abby or Charlie, as they were known, was like, oh, didn't we meet at conference? Or like, how have you been up to these days? And implying some kind of prior connection between them. And apparently, because MPs have got a problem, two messages later, they're sending dick pics. Well, I don't understand the intervening steps, but there we go.
Catelyn Moran did make a very good point about this, which is that no female parliamentarian ever would get a message saying, can I see some photos of your private parts? And say, oh, yes, great, of course, thank God you've asked, yes. So there's something in that. And, yeah, I mean, William Bragg is a senior. We can say senior. He's my age.
So he's junior then?
He's a young whippersnapper. Tory whippersnapper.
He was the chair of select committees and he was part of the Common Sense group of MPs. So he was, I know.
That's very funny.
The jokes indeed do write themselves.
I've forgotten that.
But the really sad thing, I think, about what happened to him is that he essentially sold out all his colleagues, and that's why I don't think he could survive keeping the Tory whip, was that after he did send some of these photos and there was some suspicion about other things, he said, they had something on me. He then gave people the details that then allowed them to do more phishing of other people, and that's what kind of led him to get isolated.
And the interesting thing about that is that it seemed to be on a bit of a knife edge for several days, and that slightly does show you how much things have changed or how much the acceptance of this kind of sexual communication has altered, because lots of MPs, I think Jeremy Hunt stuck up for him and said he's been really brave to talk about how mortified he is about this and how foolish he feels like he's been. So
they wheeled Dowden out, who wouldn't say it's time for him to go. Hence the eye cover about getting Willie out, which was just irresistible, like all the other jokes. But now we're in a position where it's acceptable for him to represent his constituents, but it is no longer acceptable for him to sit on, the select committees, which are about behaviour in public life. I mean, this is what those committees are for.
Yeah.
And up to that point, quite a lot of Conservatives were saying, no, he hasn't done anything, leave him alone, it's his private life, for heaven's sake, all the usual stuff that is wheeled out.
Because they've all done it too. I think that's the thing, isn't it? When you look at the sheer number of people who've been convicted of crimes from MPs, we are at the moment selecting a genuine, much higher than the general rate in the population of people who've got very bad risk-taking behaviours. The one thing I would say about this is we don't know exactly who's behind this. It doesn't seem to be state-sponsored, but there is a concurrent problem, particularly over WhatsApp and messaging services, of state-sponsored actors. So Israel makes a spyware software called Pegasus, which it has now restricted the sales of, but was being used potentially by the UAE. For example, if you remember the very big divorce case of Princess Haya and the Sheikh, that they were trying to infiltrate senior phones in the Foreign Office and potentially in Downing Street. I've just got a BBC series that's all about messaging, and I interviewed Dominic Cummings, and he said he'd had a similar approach. And I said, was it from a kind of high dom, I'm a hot girl in your area? And he said, no, it wasn't. It wasn't a foxy Natasha, as he put it. He said it was the other kind. It was someone pretending to be a PPS, a personal private secretary, like a bag carrier for Boris Johnson, spoofing that phone number, basically. And of course, this is the thing. So much government communication now happens on these messaging services. If you get a message on your phone tomorrow that it looks like it's from me, can you be absolutely sure it is from me? And I say, wow, Andy, let's just repeat that joke you made about Ian. and I think that's the thing. People just have a level of trust in these messaging apps that they assume that they are from who they say they are.
This is sort of much more common, I think. You don't actually need to go in the dick pic route at all.
No, Jeff Bezos had an affair. He's now with the Lauren Sanchez, the woman that he was with. But the way that got exposed by the National Enquirer was that he was sent a WhatsApp message with a link and he clicked on it. And he hired a private consulting firm who traced it back to Saudi Arabia. Now, they deny it. But this is absolutely in the every state in the world, including lots of states that are hostile to Britain, do have technologies like this that are all about infiltrating phones. And most of them, one of the things that they do is they try and turn your phone essentially into a listening device. So now you have bugged yourself, right? You are now carrying the bug that records all of your conversations around with you all the time, into the loo with you, Andy. Think about it. Think about what these spies are hearing.
No, I put mine in the pouch before I go to the loo every time, obviously. But
and in Bezos' case, it was because Bezos owned the American publication which published Khashoggi and then supported him. And, you know, one hates to say nice things about Bezos, obviously, but the fact that he absolutely stood by Khashoggi and then turned up when he went to Istanbul and he went and stood outside in the protest, you thought, well, this is good. I mean, someone tried to fish him and he got totally revealed, but he stood by his original story.
It's worked out quite well in the sense that one, which is that he seems now very happy with the new woman who wore an extremely eye-popping dress to a White House reception. Just treat yourself to looking that one up. It's quite eye-catching, let me put it that way. But they seem very happy together. His former wife has now got a new partner and has given away billions to charity. Absolutely billions. She said she got a massive multi-billion pound divorce settlement, Mackenzie Scott, and she's trying to disperse it all.
So, hang on, what you're saying
is hats off to MBS.
Yeah, so actually, Ian, let's pose a moment to say actually the Saudis did a really good thing here that has really helped the world.
Finally, we're sticking up for that. I'm so glad we sold that steak, by the way, Ian, to the Saudis. It's great. You know, Yevgeny was right.
I do think it's really interesting, though. You said essentially with Jeff Bezos, he just sort of brazened it out and said, you know, whatever, I don't care. And actually, presumably, that's the way to go with these things, isn't it? I mean, there are two solutions to this. One is don't send your pictures of your willy to anyone. A second one, I suppose, is send pictures of your willy to everyone so then it can't be used to blackmail you. I mean, maybe whack them at the top of your constituency website. Yeah, there's a gag there because underneath it's going to say the member for wherever. So that will be good. But, I mean, I was thinking back, I mean, we're going back 10 or 15 years now, Chris Bryan and his underpants, I mean, was on, I think it's even before Grindr, I think it was on Gaydar or one of those kind of really early dating sites. And the main takeaway from that for a lot of us, I mean, he stayed in Parliament, been an extremely effective parliamentarian and chaired select committees.
You're on the Standards Committee.
And the main takeaway from that, really, for a lot of people, I think, was, blimey, Chris Bryant looks good for a bloke in his 50s, doesn't he?
I think that's the thing. I, in some ways, wonder if Chris Bryant leaked that himself. If I look like that in my 50s, you better believe I'll be leaking those photos.
Good, well...
Well, that's reduced everyone to silence, quite rightly.
The way that scandals work has changed, and I think William Ragg would have survived texting dick pics to people, frankly, but what the problem was selling out his colleagues, and that's what made it untenable. And I think you're right, the scandals have changed. It's like a simple affair, I think people now do not... I mean, obviously, Boris Johnson's entire career suggests that is not something that is now a hard stop on your political career. And we've become less moralising about that. But perhaps we've become more moralising about kind of other things about speech, for example. You know, about what politicians say and and hypocrisy in their private life in other ways.
But Joe Haynes clearly said, "I can reveal this, even though it's incredibly late in the day, because history needs to know why Harold was in a good mood during his last term of office." I mean, historically, that's quite odd, and with many things with Joe Haynes, I wish he'd admitted them a bit earlier. The whole of the Maxwell years might have been very, very different had he done so. But the argument presumably was that in those days, Wilson had two affairs with people inside his workplace, both of whom people who worked for him. That wouldn't be tolerated now either. Mm. And the fact that no one complained about it and the very old men now who reveal it say, well, it was all a bit of a laugh and good for Harold. It really cheered him up because everyone else was so awful. The evidence is it didn't cheer his wife up hugely, did it?
No, but you know what I mean? People have got much more moralising about things that are perfectly legal, like age gap relationships now. Whereas, you know, if you had someone in their 60s dating a woman in their 20s, actually, I think in the 70s, that would have been kind of good on him. And now people would be very tusk about it.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, our sexual morality just changes. And as you say, the power dynamics now would be the real sticking point.
And I have to say as well, that on a historical note, we're maybe making an assumption there because Mary Wilson and Marcia Faulkner stayed very, very good friends right until the end of their lives.
So,
yes, but right the way through. I mean, Mary Wilson died, I think, last year, the year before, the age of 101. Marcia Faulkner went a few years earlier in her 90s. And great mates all the way through. So whatever the sexual politics were there, they were maybe a bit more complicated than than we're assuming from outside.
What a lovely story.
Okay, now let's come on to one really interesting final story, which is, do you know what? In a funny way, it kind of ties together everything we've been talking about.
Uh-oh.
Yep. This is a story that broke a couple of days ago. Actually, there's no underpants in this at all. This is a story about Graham Stewart, who until 2 days ago was the Minister for Net Zero. He has stepped down, not because of any differences of politics, anything like that. He stepped down to defend his constituency seat at the election, whenever it may be. And he's joined a growing list of ministerial quitters. So I think there are nearly 10 now ministers who've quit during Sunak's first, how long has he been in? 18 months, just over. Mm. And this is...
quit saying, I absolutely support Rishi Sunak, but I couldn't possibly be in his government, yes, and defend my own constituency, or even I couldn't be in his government and face life generally. I'm out.
That's exactly it. So all three of the most recent quitters, Graham Stewart, James Heapy, Armed Forces, and Robert Halfon, Education, Skills and Apprenticeships, all of them were supportive. And I would presume there's a little bit of a bump if you're a minister standing in your constituency. People think, oh, he's, you know, he or she's an important person. So, you know, I'd be a bit more likely to vote for them. All of them stepped down. And Robert Halfon's letter was really bizarre. He quoted Gandalf in his resignation letter.
I love that resignation letter. He was talking about the One Ring. You have to go on without me.
Yeah. He also said, it is no longer my task to set things to rights, which is what Gandalf says at some point to... I think it might be Bilbo. Anyway, but this is a really strange trend. And it is
bizarre. And it's not sort of taken off as a story, even though it is a definite trend, because it doesn't fit the narrative that everyone's after at the moment, which is Tory infighting and they all hate each other and they all want to get rid of Rishi. And it's very, very odd. I mean, to quit with an entirely supportive letter and no apparent reason is bizarre.
I think there is a reason, and I think that reason is called a COBA, isn't it? You know, there are the jobs for ex-MPs and ex-ministers is a relatively limited pool unless you're going to go and, you know, work at Butlins or whatever it might be. Yeah. So I think there is a sense that people are already job hunting.
So if I'm Graham Stewart and I've stepped down and I want to get a job working in something that's related to my brief, something net zero-ish, I've got presumably 6 months longer now, or rather my period where I won't be able to take lucrative work.
Will be cut.
Yeah, where I'll be able to
go in on the day after the election. Morning after the election, new job, hello, here I am.
And also you should be updating your LinkedIn and getting your CV ready and getting a jump on absolutely everybody else who is also going to be fighting for that same set of jobs.
That's really interesting because George Freeman, I don't know if you remember his name, he was a science minister until, I think, about November. And he left. And then a month or so ago, he said, well, one of the reasons that he quit was about his mortgage. Which had gone from £800 to £2,000 a month.
God, I remember that. Yeah. How could this have happened? He said, "It's so expensive."
That? Yes. Yeah.
Can't make it. I can't pay £80,000 a year.
Things have not worked out as I had hoped.
I mean, and he basically was saying, "Look, on my ministerial salary, which I think was about £120,000, he would rather have second jobs, which you can do when you're an MP." And which is, I think impossible when you're a minister.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was, I mean, it wasn't his whole reason. It was the bit that got picked up from his long Substack article explaining why he'd gone.
But Adam's exactly right. That is a much more wounding way to do it. If you say I'm resigning because basically our economic policies have torched the landscape so much that I, somebody who's earning in the top 3% of salaries in the country, can no longer afford my mortgage. Yeah. I mean, that is actually about the worst thing you could say about the Tory government of the last 14 years, really.
Well, the thing we've been taught by Boris Johnson and actually by Jeremy Corbyn before him is that actually resigning on principle in an attempt to oust your leader doesn't really work, does it? I mean, how many did it take? 58 people resigned from Boris Johnson's government before he actually really gave up the ghost and moved?
As part of this, I found a really great graphic that was posted by the Institute for Government, and they had calculated ministerial resignations over time for all the most recent prime ministers. So it's quite sort of nerdy, but it's really fascinating because Blair and Brown, they kind of tick up on average. Cameron, very low number of resignations. Turns out that was actually relatively stable in terms of ministers resigning. Sunak is obviously right at the beginning of that. So he's, you know, at the time they posted this, he'd been in for a year and he'd had 5. And now I think he's got 10, which is on a par with Boris Johnson, interestingly. But Boris's line obviously goes pretty high, pretty high. And then it just climbs vertically. It just ascends this ice face and goes right up. It's fascinating.
But it's also part of the fact that whatever happens in the next election, even if the Tories do better than you currently expect them to on current polling, the party's going to look very different. Because actually, one of the things I think is interesting is people like Robert Halfen, who I think there's a wide level of respect for across the House as a campaigner on stuff he cares about. Nick Gibb, who was just a very solid junior minister in education, you know, he's just one of those people who's renowned as being kind of on top of the brief. A lot of that people in that core bit of the party have gone, I've seen enough. Much like the Queen after meeting Liz Truss. They've seen enough.
It's time to leave.
Yes.
I wonder if a Cobra could put something in that said you could only take a job of national importance, such as, say, working in a care home. And then we could fill a number of them with...
I don't want my care home to be staffed by... No offence to them all.
That'd be your worst nightmare when all of you are in there with dementia. I mean, the first question they ask is who's the Prime Minister, which is almost impossible to answer these days because it's changing so often.
What Helen says about the sort of the number of people changing over, it is striking. Last election, I think it was about 50 changed over out of 650. This time, at least 102 have already said they're not standing again. And I saw something online recently saying it's about 1,000 cumulative years of experience that the House of Commons is losing. Which, when you put it like that, is sort of mind-blowing, and you know, it's extraordinary.
That makes sense. I mean, Harriet Harman, who's currently the mother of the House, is leaving. She's been in Parliament since 1982, so more than 40 years.
Right.
And there are a number of people who, in that sense, Theresa May, who's been in Parliament since 1992, is going, you know, there is just, like, a lot of the old grandees have now, this is a watershed election. Do you want to know a really horrible statistic, which is throughout the 20th century, more Labour MPs used to die while they were still MPs. And it was largely because actually the party had a lot more people who were like former mine workers. You know, they'd had really hard manual jobs and they made it to their 60s and their heart gave out. So there was always a thing that more Labour MPs died in office than Conservative ones.
But now no longer true.
I don't know if that will be true because only 4% of MPs are formerly from manual occupations. So everybody has previously had a white-collar job and presumably does not have lungs that are full of coal dust or whatever it would have been.
But it's not just the grandees going, is it? It's a lot of those kind of red wallers in 2019 intake, and people like Deanna Davison is going, isn't she?
Jamie Wallace tried to find another seat but couldn't, you know.
Mary Black, who was baby the house for the SNP.
She came in 2015, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, but she's still only about 25 or something, isn't she? We are losing an awful lot of people. Well, I suppose the argument is that you're going to get, you know, kind of some new blood coming in as well and new people with different life experiences, possibly. But then does that actually just mean you get an awful lot of Jared O'Mara?
What makes really good and effective parliamentarians, basically? Because at least a component of it will be your experience of getting laws passed, sitting on committees, scrutinising legislation, ensuring that, you know, your department, whatever that might be, is doing its job well, or, you know, leading it. That is a big part of it. So there aren't many other workplaces that are like this, really, where you...
Well, that was a big part of why Keir Starmer wanted to bring in Sue Gray as his kind of effective chief of staff, to have somebody with experience of actually running the civil service. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if Labour get in, I think Ed Miliband served in the last Brown cabinet, and Bec Cooper But this is a largely a group of people who have no ministerial experience. They've only ever been in their whole career as shadow ministers. Mm. And you mentioned the Jared O'Mara problem. The problem with Jared O'Mara is he won in Sheffield Hallam, didn't he, from Nick Clegg. Mm. That was a seat that Labour were not expecting to win. So I think there was a situation where a couple of those Labour candidates in that election were not as well vetted as perhaps one might have hoped. Mm. And again, we've talked several times on this podcast about the very tight grip that David Evans, the General Secretary of the Labour Party, and Keir Starmer have got in selections. But they're very aware of the fact that they've got a huge number of people who are coming in. You would expect the most of them to be in Parliament for 2-3 terms. It's both an enormous amount of power and also really don't let in people who are going to be a massive pain in your butt for 20 years to come.
Because there's going to be a lot of jobs to fill.
Mm. Yeah.
So vetting the people now...
Lots of them are going to be in the seats where traditionally you would have put the kind of the 25-year-olds who are fighting an unwinnable seat, but, you know, it's good experience for them on the way to getting one in future. They are going to end up like Jared O'Mara in those seats, aren't they?
So, normally you say the home counties, you'd have put a paper candidate in and said, you know, good luck, you'll get a lot of experience. But some of those people might genuinely overturn, if polling continues as it is, 10,000, 15,000 seat or vote majorities.
Graham Stewart, who's just stepped down from Net Zero, has a majority of 20,500. He said, I'm stepping down to defend this completely unwinnable nightmare seat. Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. When you're always trying to work out whether or not what the polls are true and are they picking stuff up, you have to look at the fact that the Tory MPs are voting with their feet, that they think the polls are right. Mm-hmm. And I'm bearing that in mind very much.
And it does just lead to, I mean, all of these people quietly going out the back door with nice letters to Rishi, does just give even more of the impression of a dead government walking, doesn't it? They're just kind of trudging towards defeat they can see coming.
When I was doing a little bit of reading before this, I found out there is an official Association of Former Members of Parliament, which is nice.
House of Lords now.
they have a magazine which is called Order, Order. It's rather sweet. Yeah.
That's quite sweet.
It's very nice. It's a good-looking mag.
I suppose you could be more positive. You said we're losing a huge amount of experience of office and working out how things work. But we're also losing a huge amount of experience of being useless and not getting much done and taking quite a lot of other jobs on the side and doing a bit of lobbying. So it could well be swings and balances. I don't think you should be too sad.
Okay.
But there's a bit of a clear out going on.
Well, I have really thought things have been going very well for a long time, Ian. So actually, I am sad about it.
Do you want to do a quick quiz?
Yeah.
Quick quiz on jobs that MPs have gone on to. Yes. So I've limited this to people who ran for the leadership of their parties, didn't make it. So I'll start you off with a nice easy one. David Miliband.
International Red Cross.
International Rescue.
International Rescue, that's great.
He
Thunderbird
now works
5.
For Thunderbird.
Ran to be Labour leader against John Smith, lost rather badly. Brian Gould, what did he do next?
Brian Gould.
Did he go to New Zealand?
He did. He took it so well. He stormed off thousands of miles to become Vice Chancellor of a university in New Zealand.
I thought he had.
Okay.
No, I'm leaving.
Jackie Ballard, do you remember her? Ran for Lib Dem leader against Charles Kennedy.
Primary school teacher?
Nope. She ran the RSPCA.
Oh.
Boss of the RSPCA. And the last one, Mark Oton, her colleague who then stood against Ming Campbell and lost. He became chief executive of the International Fur Trade Federation, which goes to show that the Lib Dems are a very, very broad church, doesn't it? RSPCA and the International Fur Trade Federation.
Some of us love mink, some of us want to make them into coats.
Okay, that's it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to send a question, a comment, some unalloyed praise to our email address, we are private-night.co.uk. We're going to have some more questions from you soon, and we're going to do our best to answer them. And if you'd like to get even more Private Eye before your next installment of this podcast, why not go and buy a copy? Go to private-night.co.uk and click the big red button marked subscribe. This episode, as always, was produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. We'll be back again soon with another one. Thanks for listening.